Now, good morning, Carl. How you doing today?
Oh, I'm fine. Just
Okay,
staring
that's
at.
fine.
Oh, I'm fine.
Staring out my front window.
Just
Oh
staring
shit!
at. Oh, I'm fine.
Staring out my front window.
Just
I got a
staring at.
blue
Oh,
one.
I'm fine.
Staring out my front window.
Just staring at. Oh, I'm
Oh, I'm
fine.
staring out my front window.
Okay,
I think that fixed it. I forgot to mute a certain thing. If I don't mute a certain thing, I get a an infinite loop, and it's amazing to listen to. So I'm gonna pull a quick one on the chat here, and I'm going to surprise them because they think that they've been watching a show all day, but they've really been watching a show inside a show, and they did not know that. So that's how's that prefer? Take that, NNR.
Yeah,
Night Nation.
reverse Uno card.
That's right. Welcome back. This is your third appearance on the Flood Show. The crowd loves you. You're one of the most highly requested guests as far as people to come onto the show. And so I appreciate that you join us in the morning and give us a couple of hours, especially on a holiday week. Things have been kind of crazy, but I hope that you're having at least a good holiday season and that everything's going well with you and yours. I know that you told me about some misfortune recently. Hopefully that's getting better. And
Yeah, it's fine. It's just, I just announced it on X just to tell people because I think it's worth just being honest with people about that kind of thing. So my father got hit by a, as everyone knows, my father got hit by a Dindu on a scooter, and his he fractured his femur, and he's out of hospital now, but he's okay. He's just doing his thing. He's in
man,
the other room, so.
it's crazy. We're seeing this happen all the time. I know where I live, there are illegals that are constantly crashing things, crashing big trucks, and it's just kind of nuts, man. That all these countries are having to suffer these imports and these people that shouldn't be here. And of course, when white people are victims, there's very little done about any of that. I hope that he's doing well, and we certainly send our best from our show. And if we can help support in any way or help him out, we'd love to do that. So keep that in mind. So Carl's a professor of history, in case you guys don't know. And if you haven't heard him before, you're in for a real treat today. And Carl, when I asked you to come on the show, I contacted you last night just sort of as a courtesy because I was doing some preparation and I thought, I wasn't sure what direction I was going to take today's interview in, and there's been, a lot of hectic craziness and confusion around the holidays. But I've kind of been going through personally, and I know a couple of my friends have as well, sort of a confidence crisis in our movement. And I kind of equated it to, a lot of actual events that have been happening recently. But after talking to you, you seem to you're really able to provide some historical context to things, particularly with regards to anti-Semitism as it becomes a national thing, more of a mainstream thing. And I've kind of felt like my confidence problem came from, a kind of the narrative being sort of taken away or taken out of our hands a little bit. We used to be like the sole proprietors of that particular narrative, but as we're starting to see more mainstream people kind of take up the JQ, or as I like to call it, the JP. It almost seems like we're losing a sense of purpose or something. And you actually said that there's a significant historical parallels to other times and places. Could you elaborate on that just a little bit?
So in history, people often assume the Third Reich came out of nowhere, or they say that the it came out of the defeat of Germany in 1918, from 1914 to 1918, and the Treaty of Versailles of 1918, 1919. But the truth is that it came about. It comes from a lot earlier than that, and a lot of people kind of ignore that in part because it complicates the issue quite substantially of trying to claim that it's some kind of irrational aberration. So to give you a bit of historical context, Europe in the 19th century, really, because it predates National Socialism by decades. And what happened is that in the, so Europe of the mid 20th century, so mid 19th century, sorry, was a very, wasn't quite the place that a lot of people tend to think it as, because a lot of people in the Anglosphere, Americans, think of, you know, the Wild West, the drive west, the birth of the nation, etc., where, and plus the Civil War, and then you've got Britain, and Britain's focusing on building its empire and you know, going outwards and conquering India and everything that comes with it. But in truth, the what we might call the mid to high Victorian era of the 1850s till the 1870s is really a time of an awful lot of big wars in Europe. Notably, the French fought the Austro-Hungarians, the Austro-Hungarians fought the Prussians fought the Prussians fought the French, and we also have a bunch of nationalist movements coming in around the Balkans, which is where the First World War comes from. And we also have the creation of Italy by Mazzini and his links to Freemasonry and all that kind of jazz. And we have, there's a lot going on in this particular point in time, but there's also a lot going on in North Africa and the Middle East. You've got things like this is probably, you haven't heard of it, but something called the Damascus Trial or Damascus Affair, where a ritual murder allegation was made against the Jews in Damascus, Syria, which is quite topical, obviously, particularly because one of the old defense ministers for Assad's father wrote a book on it, Mustafa Talas's, it's called Blood Pass. I think it was Blood Pass. Was it Blood Passover? No, it was something or other. The Matzo of Zion. Sorry, in 1981, that's what it was. Okay. No, Blood Passover is Ariel Toas' book. But coming back to that, basically, we start to see a lot of things that occur basically 90 to 100 years later, in 1840. That's the origin of the 6 million figure, in my opinion. It's after that we begin to see it. So the first traces of it occur in and around the 1840s to 1860s, where, so as a population statistic for Jews in Russia, weirdly enough. But it comes in, its first mention is in relation to the Damascus Affair of 1840. Now, it's worth repeating what's going on here, in that you've got large amounts of conflict in Europe. A lot of that conflict is actually funded, or at least partially funded, by Jews, which is where the Rothschild family comes in, because they made quite a lot of money off that, plus the Napoleonic Wars of years earlier, among other things. So, like Prince Metternich of the Austrians was, for example, funded by the Rothschilds to a significant degree in the post-Napoleonic age. So then we have a situation where we've got a lot of Jewish influence going on. We've got rising national consciousness. We've got wars coming on. We've also got the concept of race coming into its own. We've got Arthur de Gobineau talking. We've got other biologists talking about this concept, and they start talking what we might call the terms of Semitism. So the first person who really talks about this in terms of Semitism is a German called Wilhelm Marr. He coins the term anti-Semitism, or is believed to have coined it, but actually didn't. It predates him slightly, but he didn't know that at the time. But even then, a lot of the original anti-Semitic thought comes from the French, weirdly enough. It comes from a lot of French writers writing in a Catholic vein about the Jewish question, and linking the French Revolution to the Jewish question, among other things. That's around the 1870s, although you have a bit of it in the 1860s and a little earlier, with people like Georges de Moisigneau and his Juif, le Judaisme et le Peuple Chrétien, and things like that, and books like that coming out. And then this kind of jumps. It jumps over to Germany in the years after the Franco-Prussian War, which, of course, Prussia wins and Germany is created. And the man principally responsible for that is a man called Theodor Fritsch of Leipzig. Now, he's a publicist, and he quotes de Moisigneau's Le Juif, among other things, but he writes a book called Anti-Semitic Catechism in English, which is later republished as The Handbook of the Jewish Question. Where he comes in is he's a figure who is he lived to 1933. His books were on the original car membership cards, the NSDAP, on the back. There was a list of books, of which I think at least one of them was Fritsch's, his Riddle of the Jews' Success, which is available in English. And we've also got, and so he's there, he's promoting, he promotes, among other people, Ma. He promotes Ma's ideas, but fundamentally, he's the alt. So Theodor Fritsch is the alt, is coined by Hitler in 33, the Altmeister of the NSDAP, aka the old master, the intellect, the man who created it. And
Wow.
Hitler was being sincere, because if you actually read the reason, the Riddle of the Jews' Success, there is, I think, one or two chapters in it where he talks about the then very recent publication of Werner Sombart's works about Jews and capitalism, etc. And he does it, he spends, must be about 30, 40 pages. He talks about it in some detail. And you can, if you know National Socialism, you can just see it. It's very, very obvious where a lot of Hitler got a lot of thought from. And that's backed up by the fact that that's actually on the early NSDAP membership cards in the back of them as part of their reading. So
Wow.
where that all factors into the whole Black Pearl thing, because this creates this massive movement. So you've got the French pushing very hard against back against Jewish influence in France, and there's a series of things that build into that. You've got the Panama scandal, which basically Jews helped fund the Panama Canal, and then it went bust, and Jews cost a lot of French people their money. And there's a bunch of other scandals as well, but I'm not going to go into them. And then you've also got the Dreyfus trial, which occurs in the late 19th century, which is of course about Albert Dreyfus, the Jewish officer. Was he a traitor to Germany, etc.? And this becomes a whole thing, and there is a massive argument. And often now, it's often said that it was all about prejudice, but the reality is, you had France was split in two. You had everyone was on different sides. You had some very big luminaries in the world. The guy who invented fingerprinting, Bertillon, believed to Dreyfus guilty, for example. So you have a lot of people who aren't. You know, they're not just all like anti-Semitic loonies, as they want to style them. They are very normal people. They're very competent people, and they're saying he's guilty. And even a lot of Dreyfus's modern defenders and modern biographers have said, you know, Dreyfus didn't help himself. He was the most unlikable, non-guilty man they could think of. So basically, no one liked him. Everyone hated him, and you ended up in a situation where he may or may not have been guilty. It seems he probably wasn't, but he did nothing to help himself. Absolutely nothing. If anything, he undermined himself, and then he kept trying to bribe people. He's supposed to get trying to bribe people, as I remember. But again, it comes back to creates this whole tsunami of anti-Jewish thought publications. There's huge amounts of publications at this time. You've got Edouard Drumont's La France Juive. You've got a variety of German publications. You've got Theodor Fritsch pumping out must be about one or two books a year at this point. Plus, he's the proprietor of a publication called The Hammer, which is again a very proto-NSDAP publication. And you've got others also going on in the background. But again, what's happening is you've got this formation of these groups, these what the Goethe call them anti-Semitic leagues, anti-Semitic political parties, explicitly so. So that was their whole thing. And then kind of in the wake of and in and around the time of the Dreyfus trial, this begins to change. A lot of these anti-Semitic parties begin to collapse. Now, again, they don't tell you this in part because it tells you that of how it works, for lack of a better term. So there's two real authors on this who've commented extensively, and that is Peter Pulitzer and Richard Levy. They're both Jewish, but their books are pretty good ones about how it works. They disagree with each other slightly about the whys, but they both broadly agree that it's because anti-Semitism by that point had become mainstream. It was no longer a consciously differentiated position, and so you had a lot of groups. I can't remember the name. It's like the League. It's like there was groups like the League Anti-Juif in France, for example, which basically engaged in an armed siege against the French police in 1898 over anti-Semitism, strange enough. kind of pivoted towards being more anti-Mason, anti-Freemasonry. And you had a couple other organizations also pivot away from anti-Semitism explicitly in the title, more into like a more generic thing. And again, you have to remember the context also is you've got people like Engels, the man who basically created Marxism in many ways. He's writing against a man called Ed Durin. Durin, of course, is German. He's a German anti-Semite, but he's also a left-wing economist and nationalist. So again, you get, and then basically we get this foundational document of Marxism called Anti-Durin, for lack of a term. And Durin responds with a book called On the Jewish Question, the Judenfrage. And he responds, and you have this weird back and forth where Engels is trying to argue like vague Marxist historical theory, whereas you've got Eugen Durin like bellowing hatred of Jews right back at him, which is a slightly bizarre scenario. But it gives you this idea that what's occurring in the 1880s in Germany and France and in Europe in general, that you've got this massive, well, for lack of a term, shitstorm of anti-Semitism coming out. But this suddenly sort of really begins to dissipate in around 1900 after the failure of the Dreyfus trial, and Dreyfus gets found innocent, and you know, all of a sudden the anti-Semitism is no longer a point of differentiation. But this thing just simply goes quiet. So it kind of becomes normal that basically most people have some degree of anti-Semitism at this point. They recognize Jewish power as a thing. And a great example of that, if you've never read it, is J.O. Hobson's book from 1903 on 1902 called Imperialism, which became headline news in Britain some years ago because someone quoted it, a Jewish political figure on the left quoted it, and Hobson fingers Jewish influence behind the Second Boer War in South Africa. As part of his points, so of course that got kicked out into the thing. But it gives you an idea that a lot on the left, that on the left, on the right, everyone agreed there was a Jewish question. It was a problem, and some of the responses on the left were pretty extreme. People like Sidney Hook, Lord, I can't remember his name now, wrote Soviet Communism and New Civilization, and he had his wife. Sidney Potter, it was something else. Anyway. I can't remember his name for the life of me, but anyway, he wrote extensively about how he wanted to sterilize every Jew in London at one point. And so this is a bloke writing. This is a quasi Marxist then around the 1900s, early 1900s, writing this, which tells you how much anti-Jewish thought had really seeped into left and right. But it goes quiet. So what we're now facing is everyone now realizes Jewish influence is a thing. That we aren't making stuff up. We've been right all along. But they are sitting there basically saying, oh, you've been right all along, but we're going to try and nick this from you. And the answer to that, ironically, is to see what people did with that originally. Some people tried to move away from it to try and retain their popularity. They tried to move away from it. They tried to focus on other things. But the truth was, is the people who just had it as part of their ideology at the start, people like Theodor Fritsch and other people like Charles Maurras in France, who created Action Française in the 1920s, you have this radical, the point being that they took it as part of their ideology, and it was an uncompromising part. It wasn't some, you know, okay, we're going to get ahead by criticizing the Jews here. It was part and parcel of their thought pattern. And you can kind of see that in Mein Kampf even, because if you remember, Hitler talks about Karl Luger, listening to Karl Luger in Vienna, the mayor of Vienna, around 1900. In the 1900s. And of course, he's still famous today. The irony being that Karl Luger was not really much of an anti-Semite. He criticized the Jews very publicly, but he used it for his own political benefit, whereas some of his best friends were actually Jewish, as it happens.
Right.
So, yeah. But yeah, the point is that when we are talking about our situation and seeing like everyone else is, you know, jump on the bandwagon, trying to seize the topic. We have to insist on basic priorities, like first things. First of all, they are a biological group fundamentally. That's one of the first things. It's just none of this, oh, it's just a religion. No. It doesn't work. It doesn't work as a confessional religion. It never has. Let's not even go there. Then we get the whole, it's just Zionism. No, it's not. The Jewish problem, the Jews have been acting like, as we would say, Zionists from long before Zionism ever was a thing. And we know they've engaged in mass conspiracies against everyone from the Roman Empire to Britain to Germany to, you know, it doesn't matter. We get to this point of Zionism isn't the problem. It never has been. It's a symptom of Jews. It's not because Jews are believing Zionism that they're suddenly a problem. Does that
it's
make
the
sense?
Old thing about anti-Semitism, yes, coming from the from Jews. I totally get that, and that's a lot to nutshell. But essentially, there's a lot of turmoil, a lot of war, and a lot of conflict in Europe and Northern Africa prior to 1900. And at that time, Jewish control of the media is not nearly as extensive as it is today.
Correct.
In fact, they didn't have any, probably, and so naturally. A manifestation of the anti-Semitism that arises from Jewish meddling, from Rothschild manipulation, and all of the war and death, essentially manifest as parties, even political, as political. And,
as anti-Semitic leagues and anti-Semitic parties. They would literally be the anti-Semitic party. That would be their name.
That's what we would have today if they had completely controlled the media and in anticipation of this same thing happening. Probably, laid down a lot of groundwork, against so-called hate speech, etc. Now, today we see a place where they've tried to deracinate any sort of question around the Jews, as well as make all of the struggle between people a racial struggle. Now they seem to make it a religion until they start to get criticized, and then it becomes a racial issue, which they introduce so that they can call you a racist and an anti-Semite. It's very, very predictable, but it's also very effective.
It is very effective. It's what I call the three. It's what I call the shell game of Jewish identity, because I talk about this. I've talked about this quite a lot in other times, I think. But I've said that basically Jews will often label their identity one way, but they'll use it a different way. And a great example is one of the foundational books of Jewish supremacism, for lack of a better term. Which is Cecil Roth's The Jewish Contribution to Civilization. It's basically he defines Jewishness religiously, but then he uses it racially. So all of a sudden, Jews that are Christian, so a guy who is a Nobel Prize winner was one quarter Jewish, and his father's mother was Jewish, and then basically they said, oh, and he's Jewish, even though he was Christian. So he was a devout Christian his whole life. So, in racial terms, you can say he's part Jewish. But then they're not using that as their argument. They're saying there's nothing valid, because that's not valid criteria. So that's how they keep bouncing between these definitions, and why it's, you're right, it's very effective. But it's until you point it out, and all of a sudden they get very quiet.
Yes.
In my experience.
I hate to interrupt. I've got to. I need to. I got to ask the chat something. There is some audio clipping on Carl's end, and it seems to be getting worse. Guys, 1 to 10. How bad is the clipping? With 1 being not a problem, 10, it's a big problem. If it is, we may see if we can switch over to Telegram. I know that you've got a Telegram on your phone or whatever it is, but it seems that I don't hear the clipping. I do hear a little bit of a pop, but. It seems to be pretty substantial on their end, and so if it's a 2, okay. If it's not really bad, then I'll just let it keep going. But if it's really bad, we'll switch to Telegram and see if that's better. It is a little bit annoying. I mean, I can kind of hear it. I doubt that you hear it at all, though. And so we're kind of dealing with a phantom audio problem here. Would you mind if I just what I'm going to do is I'll just, you can stay inside the chat here. I'll mute your audio and then I'll connect you on Telegram. Unless you're on a phone, then you might want to close this, but I can bring you on through Telegram. And I think at least the audio quality was a little bit better, even though it's not as clean of an interface as what we're using now. I hate to ask, but would you mind switching over to Telegram? No, he's completely dropped out. So yeah, it sounds like maybe a reception issue. I think he's on his phone. So let me try to contact him on Telegram real quickly. I'll have to mute this real quick, make a couple changes. Okay, I'm back here. We should kill the echo. And let me open up Telegram and try to get him there. Okay. He's got his settings turned on. Let me check my settings real quickly. I can't call him because of a setting in Telegram, but he can call me. So hit the phone up at the top here. We'll see if we can get him back here. It kind of stinks chasing down audio problems, but it does happen. Huh. Okay. Let me just double check here again. Okay, that went through on my phone, so let me, I'll change this setting to all, save it. Sorry about this trouble, folks, let me just, see if I can get this problem resolved. Now I have to shut it down because it's coming through on my telephone. So give me 1 second here to kill Telegram. All right, and then I'll restart it here. What the hell? It says I missed a call, but I didn't ring. Okay. Technical workarounds. This may not work. We may have to just go back to the popping. Let's see if we can. What a terrible. Well, sadly, the quick fix wasn't so quick and it didn't work. So I'll just link him back into Restream here. Maybe reconnecting will make things better. Okay, he's back in. Let me see.
Having fun with Telegram?
We're back in. I was trying to change some settings. There's a quick setting that you can change, but it didn't work. I don't know why. After restart, still didn't work. But I think it sounds better now that you've reconnected. So I think we might be in the clear here. Sorry for that,
Sorry,
man.
chat.
Yeah, it's sometimes the quick fixes aren't so quick, nor are they fixes. But I'm sorry. We were basically talking about, how anti-Semitism basically went mainstream and then collapsed.
So yeah, it went mainstream and collapsed, and then it took it never went away in the sense of what we've done now, what we've achieved now will not go away because Jews have to get back on top of that, and they
Right.
won't because they'll never be able to. That once you let the genie out of the bottle, getting on top of it again is almost impossible without something really big to do. And now that they've used the Holocaust card, they can't really use anything like that again because no one's ever going to believe them again. It's that whole, the boy who cried wolf thing. Because no one's ever going to believe that Jews were ever subject to a genocide ever again, because they've made up some huge ones, of which the Holocaust is but one.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, to come back to your point, Vlad, you were saying that Jews have used ta Jews are using tactics now. They're suing people and whatever. Even that comes from this period. This was actually. It's covered in various different books of basically the strategy of the Jews for in the 19th century to the rise of the NSDAP was basically to sue their opponents into the ground or try and outlaw them. It's always worth remembering that the NSDAP was itself repeatedly outlawed during the campsite of 1919 to 1933,
Right.
and it was filled with informers. It almost went bankrupt due to issues that came about with the amount of campaigns in 31, 32, and 33. And and basically you had people trying to split it left, right, and center, including in days before it was just days before Hitler came to power. The you had a significant chunk of the SA was trying to split off from the NSDAP because it wanted a more left-wing vision of National Socialism, which, by the way, is part of why the Night of the Long Knives happens, which everyone always gets wrong. Everyone always thinks that something happens out of nowhere. No, it's linked to 1932 to 1933 and what happened then.
That is interesting. So that is something that people do get wrong quite a bit, because I think everybody else or at least nobody else understood that aspect of the Night of the Long Knives. That's kind of funny. As far as parallels to today go, what we're seeing is an incoming administration. We're seeing war in Ukraine, war in between Russia, Ukraine, and of course Israel is attacking all of their neighbors. We should expect this to get worse, right?
Yes, because going back to the past again, people don't talk about it, but this period, really the period from about 1900 to 1914, was absolutely stuffed full of wars, small local wars quite frequently. So most of the Balkans was fighting each other at some point or another between the late 19th century and the early 20th, because of the various wars of independence and the nationalist movements, killing each other, you name it, or they're fighting the Turks. Everyone was everywhere. And today, if you look around today, you can see the same thing. You've got everyone fighting everyone else. You've got chaos in the West. You've got Jews running rampant everywhere. You have scandal after scandal, the Jews turning up. You've got mass immigration. Again, that was in the period, but the mass immigration was largely Jewish, and in this case, because a lot of Jews were coming over from the Pale of Settlement in Russia, and
Yes.
then what became the Soviet Union. And then you have all this. You have attempts to outlaw nationalist groups. You have Jews suing nationalist groups. You have trials being set up. You have all these different tactics that we see today. They were still doing them. In many respects, we had less chance the first time. Yes, we had more. We didn't have such a demographic issue, but we had a much harder time getting the word out, because at that point, if anyone who's been around the movement for a long time will tell you, the problem is to fund and do a newsletter, to do a newspaper, to get the word out, to leaflet, to get people to buy things. It's very hard. It's very hard to do.
Right.
And so you have to remember that's part of it, is that the NSDAP spent a lot of time trying to get the word out. And in fact, the period between 1919 and 1928, people often think of it as kind of dead time after the putsch of 23 and then to 28. The reality was it wasn't dead time at all. That you had a lot of people, and notably Himmler, who often gets completely shafted in credit for this. But Himmler was actually one of the biggest players in the rise of the NSDAP, other than Goebbels. Because people often say, "Oh, what about Himmler? He didn't do anything." Yeah, he did. He was at he organized the rural speakers. So he was the person. He was driving. Isn't his diary? He was driving around the villages in Bavaria and elsewhere in Germany, giving speeches, talking, answering questions, whatever. And the NSDAP had this massive bureau that Himmler organized of speakers going around and talking about local issues, getting people on side, doing the hard work. It comes back to that thing about being blackpilled. People always say, "Oh, I want to be a rock star. I want to be a great singer. I want to be this, I want to be that." But what they really mean is they want that without the work. And the work, unfortunately, is it's playing to that, that god awful in that god awful dungeon underneath, underneath some god awful dive bar somewhere, to two people and getting bottled and that kind of thing. That's what the work entails. That's what it looks like. But it's not fun, and no one wants to do it. But when they do it, you often do get somewhere, and that's the simple truth of it, because nothing happens without effort. And effort and sacrifice.
So yeah, it seems like that is definitely the hard work, the granular person to person discussion, in the smaller areas. I think we read in the Goebbels book from David Irving, basically, he comes into Berlin and he's got funding, which they struggled with at times, but large publications begin to go out by the hundreds of thousands, but that actually does gloss over the rural outreach and really, getting everybody involved took a massive amount of effort on Himmler's behalf, and really he's not widely credited as a great organizer, but he would have had to be in order to make that work.
Yeah, I mean that's the truth. I mean, I didn't realize Himmler's involvement until I happened upon it, upon and so and someone some I read someone was talking about it, having been talking about Himmler's involvement with the propaganda campaign of the NSDAP in the rural areas. And that kind of made sense all of a sudden, because Goebbels never won that much of Berlin. He won maybe 20-30% of Berlin, and that was a massive achievement. Don't get me wrong. But Goebbels was kind of the flagship. Was kind of the flagship personality. He was flamboyant. He was a great speaker. He could do all these things. Himmler was much more staid. He got on with it. He was a bureaucrat. He got on. He got things. He did the hard things rather than the flamboyant things. And again, even if you want to bring back to Goebbels, he's the one who kicked out half the NSDAP party when he came to Berlin. He basically said, "You're a bunch of degenerates. Get out of the party. You don't deserve to be part of it." So there's a lesson in that of don't be afraid to say to people, "Look, you know, you are not congruent with what we're after." Like if you're like, I don't know, gay and you're living with some bloke and like whatever, like that we can't have that. That's not part of us. You need to go sort yourself, get help, or do something. And that's the kind of logic you have to use. It's you have to say to people, look, if you want to be part of this, you've got to do something different. If not, get the hell out.
Yeah, it can't be ultra inclusive like they try to do with the other movements. It's got to have a standard and a high standard at that, right?
Yeah. And that comes back to, if you go back to any successful movement, they've always been very particular about people, about the people who are involved, and they hold them to a standard. It's people have often have this notion of that it's the idea that causes things to win. No, not necessarily. There's been plenty of good ideas throughout history, but they haven't won. Why haven't they won? Because they haven't had people in the trenches doing the hard work, spreading the faith, doing all these other things. And that's where you get into. That's where you get into the history of, okay, well, this is what a successful movement does. And for us in the current era, while we're on this, we're in the situation where we've got this quote unquote base government, such and such, so called. I'm rather doubtful personally, but
me too.
But again, you go back to history, you can see it again. Hitler even says it in Mein Kampf. What he says is, and I can't remember exactly where, but he says quite early on, don't listen to the people who say they're in positions of power and they're doing something. His point is that there was a lot of people who were saying, oh yeah, you know, I'm changing everything from within, to him and people like him. And Hitler said, no, you're not. You are sitting there trying to justify why you are in a position of authority, locally or whatever, but nothing's changing. And a great example I always give to people is how quickly the NSDAP got a hold on homosexuality in Germany. They, in weeks, they shattered something that had been a problem for decades, even a century and a century, maybe two. And it showed you what you could do if you have a will to do it. This comes back to what's often said is, the system does what it's designed to do. So the point being is that if they're not doing something about it, they don't want to do something about it. Not really.
Right.
They might say they do, but they don't. It's rhetoric versus action.
And this was a situation where there were laws against it on the books, but they weren't generally enforced until the NSDAP came to power.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a matter of weeks, literally weeks, and it was... And homosexuality and the homosexual movement was dead in Germany within weeks.
So really the way this translates to today, at least from what I gather, if I'm catching you right, is essentially that even when things, you know, start to seem to be falling apart, that's really when it's time to double down and continue to stay on course and just reorient yourself back to your position, try to avoid distractions and remember the actual work that needs to be done.
Yeah, I mean, because fundamentally, a lot of the people who are jumping on the bandwagon, they don't really care. Again, they don't really care about the values so much, per se. I mean, if someone's been red-pilled for 3 months, great. But they probably don't know a hell of a lot, and they're still in that euphoria phase of being like, oh, I found out the truth. But there will come a point, and it hits everyone. I know Andrew Joyce has talked about this. I've talked about this. People have been in for a while and all know about this. Is that when you hit, like, it's usually about 1 or 2 years in, maybe three, you'll find all of a sudden that you get very, very depressed because you know the truth, but dealing with that fact and what that means, it means you're faced with a choice. You're either going to do something about it or you're not. So either you believe it or you don't. And doing something about it has consequences. Depends what you do as to what those are, but there will be some consequences. If you want to spread the faith, you want to red pill people, you will lose friends. You will lose family. You will be defamed. You may end up sleeping on a park bench. It's going to be, you know, some things are going to happen to you that are not going to be pleasant. But the question you have to answer is, do I believe this or do I not? If I don't believe it, then I shouldn't do those things. If it's not the truth, then I shouldn't do those things. But if it is the truth, what am I doing about telling other people about the truth? And am I prepared to deal with those consequences, really? I mean, we've just had a bunch of people doxxed. I mean, their lives are going to be somewhat ruined by people who, I like about them, they're just awful people, just doxxing people. They're doxxing people just because of their political views. But we just have to be okay with that. And that's part and parcel of it, is that if you are doxxed, you are doxxed. You have a choice then. You either continue or you run away. And then I'm glad to say a lot of people have continued. They've said, sorry, they said, fuck it. I'm continuing. I'm going to work. I'm going to do the right things because I believe in this. And that's where the Jews start to lose, because you can't beat true believers per se. The only way to beat true believers is to kill them.
Right. And a lot of people will get discouraged. And like you said, they'll kind of fall out. But the NSDAP was essentially one of the core doctrines, or the fundamentals, was sacrifice. Like, these people had to be willing to sacrifice for their countrymen. And that seems to be something that's been very much eroded in today's society. Of course, the demographic mixing hasn't helped with any of that. The fake opposition between the left and the right really has just served to inflame tensions more than anything else. But you did hit on something I thought was important, and that was to stay true to the principles. And we see this a lot. What is the danger of, let's say, you know, people that are mainstreaming, or people with large followings, are taking on the JQ and they're taking it to a larger audience, but they're also deracinating the conversation at the same time. They make it about religion. They take race out of it. And I think in a way they're just trying to corral people away from, you know, the more extreme right.
Yeah, they are. But again, this is nothing new. This has been done against the right for years and years and years. The difference, I think, is that they're trying to deracinate it. They're trying to take it out of these things. But it comes back to the James Lindsay problem, whereby he's trying to promote an idea, a position which fundamentally is contrary to reality. It's contrary to what you see around you.
And fucking jacked as fuck with hate.
Mr. Carl Rattle, thanks for being a recurring guest on the Flood Show.
What was that? Was that a super chat? Hello?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I was muted. Yes, it was a super chat. It comes from a separate audio channel. I should have turned that thing off. I didn't even think about it. So let me thank you very much for the support of the show, guys. And I apologize for that. That's probably going to loop a little bit. So
it's okay.
I think that'll do it.
Yeah, I just think it was I'm trying to think where I was.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a gremlin-filled show, but I think it'll be fine.
Okay.
So essentially, yes, I forget what I just asked you, but as the mainstreaming happens, deracinate the conversation, and we kind of lose out on the aspect of the war that is, like, they are fighting a race war against us, but we're not allowed to get racial in return.
But that's where you have to insist. This is why I've often said that it's a good group to actually look to understand how to deal with this is actually Muslims, strangely enough, because they're very good at insisting on their core, what they're pushing. They're very aggressive. They insist on that's the framing. We have to be the same way. We have to push our frame and say, look, you can't look at it in terms of it being a religion. You can't look at it being Zionism. It doesn't work. And when Candace Owen starts talking about Frankists, you push back and you say, it's not just the Frankists, Candace, it's the Jews. Just generally, it's not just like some subverted group of weird Jewish heretics from whenever. It's a group of people, and they've always done this. These are the examples. And rather than looking at it as they're subverting us, think of it like they are bringing us lots of people we can then get into. We can reach those people in the comment sections, in the debates that go back and forward, with our media, with our points, with our memes, with our infographics. The more, because what happens is every time you post an infographic or you have an argument with someone and you kind of win it or whatever you want to say, you introduce that information to a wider audience, not just the person you're arguing with, the person you're talking to, it's whoever sees it. And that's what you want. You want to always see, okay, I'm not doing this for the person I'm talking to per se, I'm doing it for everyone else who might or probably will see it, that maybe one or two of them will go, oh, you know, they've got a point, I'm going to look this up, or I'm going to check this, or maybe I'm going to ask a question, another question. That's what you want to, because every time you do it, you get one more, you know, it's that hard grind of, it's not just you post a meme and 1,000 people agree with you. It's the ones, the twos, the threes, the, you know, oh, I've got a question about this, could you help me? And being open to that and saying, well, you know, I'm happy to help, you know, read this book, you know, it's there for free online. You don't have to buy anything. You don't have, you know, we're not asking you for money. That's a classic one as far as I'm concerned, is they say, oh yeah, you know, I want you to support me, give me money. Well, okay. If you really believe this, wouldn't you do it for free?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great point.
Because that's what I come across a lot. Is a lot of people there saying, oh yeah, you know, okay, well, okay, put donations on. I understand that to some degree. But, you know, to ask for money all the time and say, you know, oh, you can only access this, I'm going to paywall content and stuff like that, I don't agree with that. I never have. Because if it stands by itself, is that if you want to put it in, this is your donation to the cause. This is what you're promoting. And that's why I think people should be like that. I don't think people should be hiding behind paywalls, because, I mean, fundamentally, if you're hiding behind a paywall, who's going to see it but your groupies? I mean, come on.
Exactly. It's very it's too important to just to kind of internalize and sell and rebottle and repackage. But
yeah.
Another point that you actually make that's great, and we've seen this push from the left over the last decade to essentially bottle the right into a small group of small platforms where they can just be systematically debanked, basically shut down. I recently had my my Odyssey account demonetized, and they tell me the reason was because Stripe demanded that they demonetize a certain group of accounts. So Odyssey, which was actually very proud of themselves of being a completely free speech platform, suddenly finds themselves having to do the dirty work of demonetizing people, because the banks told them to, essentially, and they did buckle without any resistance. They just completely demonetized this channel and quite a few others. Now, when I asked them, they did tell me that it was Stripe that told them to do it, because it actually is against their terms of service for them to do that to us just over speech, you know. And of course, my show is pretty racy. I'm showing Hitler all day. I have no problem with swastikas on screen, and you know, and it's kind of a free speech stand. And I understand that there's an optics argument that some people will want to have, but I kind of tend to feel the same way. Like, I'm not going to censor myself. I'm not going to alter my programming, because it's really important that this all gets out there. And, you know, the Reich was a victim of this, of essentially war crimes, and the United States aided in that. And so the more I can throw Hitler at them, not only does he have a lot of meme credit, a lot of meme power, Hitler's very popular with a lot of people. But I think the generation that comes after us needs to know all this stuff, and they need to see it. And if that imagery helps them to, kind of identify with it, with the oppressed people, then, you know, so be it. I don't have any trouble with it. But that said, it has hurt the show a little bit. But you're right. We had to continue to do this. We've seen this trend of trying to neck down the ideological far right into a small area. And it seems to me, to be antithetical to what we're trying to do, we should be trying to spread out into more platforms, more places, taking this to, you know, take this to YouTube and get banned, take it to other places. And does it help to be subtle, or should I be more subtle, or
I think you need both.
Fly a little bit of both.
Yeah. No, so what I mean by that, Flood, is I think the way you have to look at this, you have to look at this like corporations do. Corporations understand marketing and sales, that you have a product and you're targeting a segment, right? If in segment targeting, you are doing that purely, but you're targeting that segment and that segment or that segment or maybe one or two others. You're not targeting other segments because you know those segments won't be interested in how that message is presented. But another, say another show would target those segments, for example. Like, for example, Jared Taylor is a good one, example of this. He targets the more intellectual element of it, the less, you know, the suits and booted, more, you know let's have a conversation about race, let's do facts, figures, stats, not, you know, full out how Hitler, etc. It's a different logic. And that's why I'm very sort of, okay, there is a place for everyone. I have no problem with people who want to talk about Hitler all day. I have no problem with people who don't want to talk about Hitler very much. But as long as they don't counter signal Hitler and start saying, oh, Hitler killed a million white people and stuff like that and idiotic claims and that sort, I don't have a problem with them at all. Because I view it as it's a big tent of a...
Oh, now we're in trouble. He said tent. There's a certain group of people that have been using that terminology, and but you're right. You know, this is we need a diversity of tactics. I just call it diversity of tactics.
Yeah, it's right? A diversity of tactics, if you want to call it that. It's because there's lots of people who won't be reached by one way, but will be reached by others, and vice versa. And you can't do it without everyone. So you need to adapt your propaganda to where people are, what they need to see, what they're going to respond to, but also not shit on everyone else. Because I hate this when the debates used to happen between, because these debates aren't new. These debates have been happening for 20-something years, that you have people saying, oh, yeah, you've got to present yourself a certain way, you've got to look a certain way. But the reality is, like the average blue-collar guy doesn't want to listen to a guy in a suit. He wants someone who is going to talk to him in the language that he understands he would himself use. Conversely, a CPA is not going to listen to some guy who's been a machinist his whole life and can't go 2 seconds without expletives. So you have to have someone else who talks in his language. And that's where it comes into actually being everyone has a place. There is no Aryan left behind.
And it's completely reasonable and rational, right? This is how we would approach most problems. Most people wouldn't come and try to take ownership of problems that, say, wasn't Jewish, like homelessness. Nobody is out there claiming homelessness as their specific, domain, right? So, yeah, we need people of all sorts and types to continue to press the Jew, to expose Jewish power, and to particularly, and we've seen a lot of this lately, so a lot of guys are putting themselves on the line. They're getting harassed by law enforcement, but they are demonstrating how Jews try to control the narrative and try to curtail freedom, particularly freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
So it does work. And certain people do identify with different groups in different ways. It's literally insane to think otherwise.
Yeah. And a good example actually is the old anarchists used to have a term called propaganda of the deed. And it's often associated with bombings, quite famously. But they would understand it and they would say, okay, well, if we're doing something, people will join us. If people see what we're doing, that we are the ones who are standing on the front lines and dealing with this stuff, they're going to come. People will come. If you are there and you show up, people will show up and join you. And you've seen that in the growth of groups. People have been screaming "Feds" at Patriot Front since forever, but they're still growing. Why? Because they have quite an efficient operation. I've been around some of their operations, and they're efficient. They have things sorted. They have stuff pieced out. So someone has responsibility for X, someone has responsibility for Y, and they have standards, and they show up. And right. So that's what you get is that when you do the work, people show up for you, and it's a vice versa thing. It's the social contract essentially between a group, between you and the group. If people are showing up for you, you show up for them, which is I think where it comes down to find something local to do, find something that's that other people aren't doing. Or not doing well, or whatever, and just do it better than them, and bring yourself into it. The Spanish National Socialists did this wonderfully when they brought in like gyms. They would have gyms and they would set those gyms up, and they would get working class young guys who didn't have a lot going for them. They would teach them boxing. They would teach them, you know, life. They would teach them, but they would also introduce National Socialism to them, and you've got a lot of National Socialists through that. The same way you've got various movements in Italy that do the same thing. You've had the White Rex movement in Eastern Europe, which is primarily about MMA, kickboxing, and so on, which did really, really good work in getting the message out by sport. And then you've got the Rise Above movement and, you know, RAM or whatever. And so all these groups, they're finding problems that require a solution. And there's plenty more problems. It's just people need to select what problem they want to deal with. 10, 15 years ago, I decided my problem was going to be the Jewish question. I sat down and I thought, okay, what can I actually do? What can I contribute? I'm not someone. I don't go out on the street. I don't scream at people. That's not my jam. But what is my jam is I like sitting in archives. I like books. I like to understand things, and I'm very good at sniffing out what people are hiding in terms of the intellectual world. So I thought, well, okay, no one else is doing the Jewish question, really. I mean, K-Mac had just kind of come out at that point and was kind of in the first throes of being attacked over his books. And I kind of thought, well, okay, well, I'm going to do that. That's what I'm going to focus on. I'm going to focus on the Jewish question. I'm going to focus on history. I'm going to deal with this stuff. And I've been doing it now for 16 odd years, I think, which is quite a long time.
That's pretty amazing. Folks, we're talking with Carl Rattle. He's a professor of history. He's also an avowed anti-Semite and a national socialist. You know, you make a great point because everybody kind of brings a different skill set to the table. Everybody has different kind of levels of who they can connect with and who they identify with. And identity does play kind of a big part in communication. This show will connect with certain people. Other people will gravitate toward more radical stuff. Some people like things a little bit less, you know, radical and vulgar. Mm-hmm. It is kind of important to bring a diversity of tactics. But to tell me something, there's I've always kind of conflated the movement to fight off or expose Jewish supremacy and Jewish power and kind of point out what the Jews are doing to us as a race versus the actual need for white people to unify, to collectivize, to be sovereign in their own nation. There's a bit of a white cause and an anti-Jew cause. They do go together, but at the same time, one should be a little bit more, I think, diverse or widely available. The fight against the Jew, we shouldn't turn away any help or assistance. Every country in the world has a beef with the Jew, with Israel, with Jews. But at the same time, whites are also trying to become more cohesive and less diverse, less accepting of just everybody coming to our country. There's kind of two movements going on at the same time, and it seems like at a certain point they'll need to diverge. And do you see things the same way, or are they one in the same movement? And then how do we take the worldwide fight against, you know, Jewish power and end up at a majority white nation again, where we control our own destiny?
I think they're two interrelated positions, in that you can't have the anti-Jewish fight without the fight for a Europe that is Europe and America that is America.
Yes, thank you. Europe's also in a different situation, but yeah, just also, the same question.
And as Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, it's all the same. But that's the thing, is that we need to be happy. We need to be happy that, okay, we're at a time of history. We have more of an opportunity than our forefathers did. They lived at a very different time. They had to deal with a lot of other stuff that's a lot harder than we have to deal with in many ways. William Pierce, for example, had to deal with hell, the best I can work out, in his time of having to try to create something from nothing.
Yes.
And create the national line. But coming back to that, it's like, okay, there's two different movements. You're right, in a sense, but they're interrelated, in that You can't let people strip the anti-Jewish element from being the nationalist element. That's why you have national socialism, because it's both.
Right.
Is that you can say, okay, well, it's like, for example, you can by stripping it from nationalism, what they'll do is they'll attach it to Islam or something like that. Or they'll do something similar. And they'll be like, well, this is the true anti-Jewish movement. Islam is what the next logic will be, or something of that order. Whereas we need to say, no, we don't need that, because national socialism already exists and it's far more effective. It's far better. We don't. And then you just bring up, oh yeah, by the way, Islam is Judaism, or basically universalist Judaism, which usually gets Muslims very, very upset, by the way. But that's
you're right,
the point.
Though. I see people doing that within our own movement. They you're right. If they get distracted, they end up in the Middle Eastern politics, and essentially platforming also anti-white movements that are just Muslim.
Yeah,
essentially.
And it's whoever is most insistent and the most aggressive will win. This is the lesson from how Jews work, is that you get the same kind of position. In that, if you're aggressive and you are to the point, you will be the person in charge. You'll be the person who sets the tone, and that's the person you want to be. You do not want to be the person who is being told what to do. And that's part of the lesson of history. In that, the winners, the people who ask and push, and are the people who will win. The people who say, "Oh, I don't want to offend you," will lose.
Right, the nice guys finish last.
What
we
need to do, we cannot have. Yeah, we can't have people trying to say, oh yeah, no, you need to tone down the rhetoric. You're going to drive people away. Well, who cares? If they cannot handle some basic truth, or they can't handle the reality of race, then what use are they? And why can't they handle the reality of race? One of the things that has come through years of being around the movement has been the fundamental dictum that I was taught way back in the day, was that if someone rejects national socialism and is really insistent, it's usually for a personal reason. It's not because they've got intellectual objections. They might do, and sometimes you do get that, but it's pretty rare. 9 times out of 10, there is a reason, and it's something that is common really in human behavior in general. There's always a reason. That reason is often hiding behind a justification. What is that reason? And often it is they're mixed race, as we've been finding out. There's quite a few people who hang around and say they're actually mixed race. They're Jewish. They are shanking someone who is mixed race, another race, or Jewish. Yes. Or they have relatives, or they have a best friend, or it's things like that. That's what makes people suddenly object to national socialism, because national socialism is, for lack of a better term, a total ideology. The closest comparative I can give to someone to understand national socialism is what Christianity was originally. It's kind of a fundamentalist creed, for lack of a better term, of this is the truth. You can like it or lump it. This is the truth, though, and you either live it or you don't. And when you do that with people react in one or two ways. They're either interested in accepting, or they're very, very resistant. And they're very, very resistant, there is a reason. And usually it's personal.
That totally makes sense. And we see that a lot. I've seen that mostly on Twitter, particularly in the spaces where people can kind of come up and basically get the microphone. I've seen that question come up 1,000 times. I have a mixed race children, or that, like you said, there's always some qualifier, or maybe I've got DNA that's not Northern or that's not European, 5 generations back. But there's a constant qualification, question and answer happening, and the churn is just insane. But seems like you're right. Everyone that actually resists the idea of National Socialism essentially has some reason to, and it is a personal reason. It's almost never ideological. The ideological reasons are the same ones that the Jews put out, that you're just hateful, you're just a bigot. But, we've demonstrated a million times that we're trying to save our people. into the future. So that's been thoroughly debunked, that it's about skin color or race. We should just continue to keep the walls up, though, and maintain the same high standard that we talked about before, right? That
yeah,
we
I need mean, to have there's,
a standard. That,
there's no reason we. There's no reason we can't. Carry on, sorry.
Oh no, that's. I think you're answering it correctly. But essentially, we have to. We talked about this, I think, before as a question for the future, and that it was essentially we will have to set a standard on what the final configuration or demographics of our homeland will look like. But as far as the fight against the Jews, everybody should get some.
Yeah, I mean, it's just part of it. I mean, there's no reason you could, there's no reason you can't, there's no reason you can't do both. And a lot of people try and separate them, or they try and say, oh, we know Jews are white, or we get some weird thing of the legalistic question of, you know, who is white. That's a classic one.
I see this happening on Twitter too.
Yeah, it happens a lot. But
well, I see people saying like, oh,
okay.
It's the delay. I'm seeing people say diversity works. See, we can work together against against these Jews, but ultimately diversity is fine, and we have to continue to insist absolutely that is not acceptable. That we have to continue to push the point that it is race mixing that they use to destroy these nations, including our nation, and there's no exception to that rule.
Yeah, and that's the simple truth is that. If you ask for the moon, you'll maybe get stars. But if you just ask for the sky, you're going to get like a mountain somewhere. So the point being that you have to go for the best you can, the best possible situation, and you might not get it, but you'll get something approaching it because you've been the one to insist that this is the truth, this is the position, and you've done the hard work. And there's a lot of people who want to. There's a lot of people who want to lecture everyone else and say, "Oh, I knew, you know, you're bigoted, or you've got something wrong," but they don't want to do the hard work. It's like I often get people coming at me saying, "Oh, but this comment from someone, you know, is debunks you." It's like, well, no, they've not written an article about it. They've not debunked anything I've said. They've just fired off a comment, and they haven't even given a reference half the time. So it's like, okay, well then this is why it's wrong. And then they get all upset about that. But the truth is that if you keep pushing, back, again, it's not the person you're necessarily talking to, it's everyone else. And that's what I mean by, I was talking to you last night about it, and saying, you know, it's that analogy of the computer virus. It's not, we're not going for Skynet. So, you know, we're not going to take over in a day. It's the computer virus analogy, in that the virus has to spread and spreads between networks, and then it spreads slowly and more gradually than that. It spreads fast, sometimes it spreads slow, sometimes we lose a bit of it. But that's the analogy, in that what we're actually trying to do is we're trying to infect like networks of people with our ideas to say, you know, this is the truth, and they then begin to espouse our ideas to their friends and their, you know, their people, and some of them will disagree, they'll push back and whatever, and there'll be their own little thing going on, but we will win because we are getting our message out to different groups. We're propagandizing our opinions, we're pushing them, we're very clear about what is the truth, what is not. There's no gray here, it is what it is. And also, it's, well, you know, you can go to XYZ to check that information or whatever. Everything needs to be somewhat verifiable. It needs to be solid. It needs to be well thought out to the best we can. But also, it's just to the point, and not do what the left is doing, like spiel like for 5 hours about pointless crap, and that actually could have been said in 2 minutes. So to me, that's what we need to do. We need to focus on spreading the message, living the values. That's a big one, because no one believes you if you don't live what you say. Because, you know, if you don't live it, then what's the point?
Right.
You know, why are you in this?
That's so a great that point that you make.
Yeah.
Well, you have a way of like leading. You have a way of like leading into my segues, but you're already there. I don't really even have to work at taking the conversation in the right direction. You actually hit on my next question, which was, if it's the case, and it is the case, that we need to be able not only to cite exactly what our argument is, which is that race mixing will destroy our nation. And so that's, you know, there's a great reason for wanting a vastly majority white homeland, as well as wanting the Jews out of control, out of positions of power, out of positions of influence. But we also, it's very important that we are able to articulate that that position exactly, succinctly, and you're right, not engage in a bunch of Jewish intellectualism to arrive at a point indirectly. We need to be able to drive it straight to the people within the 10 seconds that you have their attention. Is that correct?
Yeah. Because fundamentally, it's what, I mean, I often cite it, everyone who says, oh, he's a Jewish, yeah, but he's right, which is what Carl Sagan said, that if you can't explain something simply, then you don't understand it.
Was that Carl Sagan? I think I've heard that attributed to Einstein, probably
misattributed. I think that was Carl Sagan.
Could have been. Interesting.
But yeah, he was basically right in that if you can't explain something like that simply, then you don't understand it. And there's a lot of people who put a lot of verbiage out there, and you read it and you're like, what the hell is this? It doesn't mean anything.
Right. That's the first indicator. They've got a weak position, in my opinion. That's what I usually see.
Yeah, that's one of the beauties of our socialism, in my opinion, is that it's a very simple position. But it has a lot of intellectual depth if you want to go there. But it's it's very intuitive. It's very logical. Its weakness, such as it is that it is a complete transvaluation of all values. It is a true one in the sense that it's going to change how you think. It's going to change your life. It's going to make your life difficult. But your life will be better in the end because of it. And that comes back to, you know, when you find something that's worth dying for, people will die for it. But people, no one wants to die for liberalism. God's sake, I mean, I can't think of anyone who has ever really wanted to die for liberalism per se.
Right.
As we've now understood. I mean, they'll often claim they would die for your right to say it, but they won't.
No, you're right. In practice, they actually tend to fold under pressure, and we see that all throughout recent history too. Even on the, you know, the so-called Republican right are very, very weak.
Yeah.
Because they don't have a real ideological position, and they're compromising constantly. And how important is it? I mean, we're constantly offered compromise, and I think that when cornered, you know, you're going to get the offer, right? You're going to get the phone call. When we actually have our enemy on the ropes, then they're going to want to, you know, share or bribe you out of your position, and we have to be absolutely resolute in you know, carrying out the mission.
Yeah, and again, go back to the history. That's exactly what happened to Hitler. He had repeated offers to give him authority, or the trappings of authority, to try and stop him. He stuck to a very hard line of I want it all or nothing. And it caused an awful lot of ructions to the party, which is partly what caused everything that the ructions in 31, 32 and 33 was Hitler's all or nothing perspective. But he was right. And because he was right, because he gambled it all and won all, then a lot of people tried to walk back their criticisms and so forth. And that's actually what happens, is that people like winners. They do not like losers. And if you're going to act like a loser, no one will like you. I mean, it's a sad fact of life, but you have to actually believe what you say and do what you believe and then act like it. Because if you don't, people are going to notice. And
absolutely.
Yeah, look on Twitter. I mean, you've got the people follow. It's not the weird neckbeard types trying to argue with you over something. It's the hardliners who say something pointedly in as few words as possible, or with as much humor as possible. And that's what wins. It's not
Well, it's a power dynamic, right? You're right. Yeah. People gravitate toward the winner, and the winner is confident. They're short, they're direct and to the point, and they don't need to. They don't need to do a bunch of, jibber jabber to arrive at things indirectly. They have a solid position, and they can communicate it very quickly and precisely.
Yeah, it's also that concept of bringing value to someone, in that there's a lot of people, particularly on the internet, as you all know, who bring very little value. They, you know, there's this whole ecology of YouTubers and others who they do little. And they do little themselves. They think they do, or they promote this image that they do. And they, in the reality, that they get their ideas from someone else who is also on YouTube, and they get their ideas from someone else who's also on YouTube. They don't do their own work. And that's what I think a lot of people respond to. People respond to authenticity. What my wife was calling me, was saying the other day, was saying that is usually for most, who's saying that edge. We've got what women would call edge. Authenticity, which I think right. is the truth in a lot of things that we do, is that we've got to have edge. We've got to be the people who are the authentic ones. We're not the ones running away from a fight. We say what we mean. We say what we do, and that's it. And then anyone else, and then we can take it or leave it. And that people come to us. We don't go to them.
I've noticed a trend lately where a lot of people, and I conflate it with savior syndrome, but a lot of people seem to be waiting for a leader to emerge. They want to be told what to think. There's not a lot of impetus toward critical thinking or investigation or confirmation. A lot of times we're ready to just accept what we're told by someone, like for instance, a position of authority like yourself, right? If you tell me something that I think or say is incorrect, and then you correct me, I will pretty much just assume that you're right, and probably never go and check. And because there is something about being told what to think or what to believe, it relieves me of having to take the responsibility of doing the due diligence. How dangerous is that to our people?
It can be very dangerous, but that's where when we talk about. You talk about how people want people. There are people are waiting for leaders, but that again is predicated in National Socialism. National Socialism works on the concept of Führerprinzip, as in the leader principle. And there's a famous SS saying of thinking is for the horses, as in the point being is that basically you are not here to do all the thinking. You're not here to. Need a detailed justification of the ethics of National Socialism or the morality of it or the details of why is that particular racial type suitable, one is not. You just have to accept from people who know what they're talking about. And there's a lot of people who object to that fundamentally. They object to the idea that of people set of relying on other people, but they do it anyway. Everyone does it. Everyone relies on other people. I rely on certain people. If someone says to me, someone I respect says to me, look, this is the truth. This is what I believe. This is accurate. It's on this information. I might ask a question or two, but that's all. But I was like, okay, fair enough. I don't know as much as you on this. I will take what you have said as read. And there is that element of everyone is below someone else. No one is at the top that is completely responsible to no one. Even Hitler was responsible to the entire German nation. In fact, he had more responsibility than anyone else because he was the person who was responsible to millions, tens of millions, not just 5 people or 100 people or whatever. And that's just kind of how, and it's dangerous in the sense that there are a lot of charlatans who will tell you, oh, but if you just listen to my radio show every week, we're going to cause a revolution, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And it's just, it's basically entertainment, in other words. Yes. And there's a lot of them, and you can usually tell because they want money, in my experience of it.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. Yeah, you're right. Like, there's a difference in between. You need order followers. You need people to follow orders without questioning. But at the same time, you don't want people that will bow down to authority just because it's convenient or it saves them the trouble of looking into things. This is a pretty big deal. This is why it's so important to understand history. This is why it's so important to have to be educated on these things, because then you'll be able to spot who is simply trying to impose their will upon you versus who you should actually listen to without question. There will eventually be an organization, a structure, in which, you know, orders will need to be followed without question.
Yeah.
But kind of but where we're at now, we see the opposite of that, where people are basically like, hey, will you do my thinking for me and tell me what I should, you know, what I should believe and what I should argue. And we need to avoid the latter and embrace the former a little bit more.
But this comes in again, Vlad, into, again, it's a Catholic concept of the catechizing someone. So again, Theodore Fritsch used the term anti-Semitic catechism when he's in his first book. And the point of that was to say, these are the basic tenets of belief, and this is why. And so the point of the concept of catechism is that you teach someone their faith. In this case, you're teaching them National Socialism. About the Jewish question, but you're teaching them basic answers, basic responses, basic positions. You're teaching them, this is what we believe, this is why. And then if they need something more detailed, they can go to other resources. But if they've got the basic, this is why, this is the truth, at the very least they've got something as to center their beliefs on. And then it's down to others who are more au fait with the material to back that up, to explain it, to deepen their understanding or provide them other resources. Again, it's always useful to come back to competing examples of how organizations work. Because again, Himmler took a lot of his ideas from the Catholic Church and the Jesuits, precisely because they were effective. Not because he was some part of some Catholic Jesuit conspiracy, something to try and make out, but because they're effective. I mean, you take things from where they are. It's like this whole controversy around James Lindsay and whatever that's been going on about, you know, oh, you can't possibly say Marx had a point. Of course he did, because Marx, to some degree, succeeded. And if Marx succeeded, then we know that there is something there to it. It's not just that it just succeeded because it's wrong, but that's clearly not going to work. There is something there that there is a reason it succeeded. It's not just because it's bad that it succeeded or whatever. There is a reason. And when we get to the reason, we can say, well, that's why Marxism was effective. And the part of the reason Marxism actually was effective was because it was very good at catechizing, for lack of a term, the lower level people, the workers. It would explain why these things were the way they are. They would put out a lot of books. They would be very good at promoting pamphlets and all this kind of stuff. They would get to people and they would keep people. Again, that comes back to marketing and sales, understanding that it's not just about getting the sale. It's about customer retention. You want people not just red pill people. You want people to stay red pilled, and you want them to spread that. And people often forget that. People think, focus on, you know, you're red pilled, it's all fine now. Whereas the truth is, that's why I often say to people, okay, read Hitler's Revolution by Richard Tedder. It gives you a lot of what you need. It doesn't give you everything, but it gives you a lot of what you need, basics points. If you need more, go to these books. This isn't like, read Nicholas Kollerstrom's Breaking the Spell. That gives you a good outline of revisionism, Holocaust revisionism. Again, if you need more, go here, and so on. It gives people to say, okay, look, the onus is on you. You need to do some digging, but we'll be around to answer your questions, to have that conversation. And also, in what format do you want the information? Because some people really don't do well with books. Some people aren't readers. They prefer audiobooks, which again is a great concept. People produce audiobooks. I think you produce audiobooks, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. But that's another thing. You're producing that content so that someone can digest it in a different way, and it's the way they prefer. And some people prefer videos and documentaries, and that's why Europe of the Last Battle has been so effective. Because people like that. They love the power of image and sound together, and it just is. I mean, you have to deal with the truth as the truth, not as how you prefer it to be. If you want the Goebbels example, Goebbels realized this. Because Goebbels was taught, in a very early in his career, he deplored cinema. He thought cinema was pointless. He thought the radio was pointless because it was Philistine. It was, you know, it wasn't literature. It wasn't wonders of literature. Because again, everyone always forgets that Goebbels' doctorate was in literature, and specifically in plays, as I recall, playwrights. And he then realized, well, actually, I don't want to talk to the bourgeois. I don't want to talk to like the middle classes who are going to be snobby and, you know, maybe I'll be like some sort of mom, I'll sell, you know, X number of books a year and I'll make a living that way. And that's kind of pointless. That's not the life he wanted. So instead, he went to Wilhelm Raab's dictum. He said, look to the alleys, look to the streets and say, well, I've got to go to the people. I've got to spread my ideas to the people. How do I do that? And realize, well, okay, it is film. It is getting these different formats, being innovative, using different formats, you know, taking them for what they are, not just getting upset because, you know, the march of technology, the march of progress, as you might say, and focusing on that. And we as people need to really push, like keep innovating, keep pushing, keep at the bleeding edge, because the more at the bleeding edge of, you know, everything from, you were talking about AI last night, but everything from podcasting to, you know, video making to documentaries to, you know, just talking on X, Twitter and social media, new platforms that we get on. Great. Because the more we do that, the harder it is, because fundamentally the enemy's having to play whack-a-mole. And whack-a-mole is not an easy game to play. Because you have to employ a lot of resources to whack each mole, and the more moles that keep popping up, the harder and harder and harder that game gets. Which is why they try and do mass deplatforming, because it's a way around playing whack-a-mole. But because of Elon Musk and how that's all worked out so far, that's not been successful as of yet. Although we're starting to see some of the old Twitter come back, as I'm sure you're aware. I think we just have to keep pushing. And the more we keep pushing, the more we keep our political development, again, that's another concept from communism, the concept of political development, and that you should be, that your political education, it's not just a one and done. It's not you read Mein Kampf and then you're done. You should be reading, like, I don't know, maybe a book a month, like a movement book a month or something like that, something small, and just kind of continuing on with your education, you know, having a chat every once in a while with people, trying to get people to see the truth, or, you know, recommending something to someone, say, well, I think this is why, but, you know, look, you know, look what Israel's doing. If we were America first, why is America always Israel first, not America first? You name it, you can just do it. And then what will happen is people will come to look at you as an authority, as someone who is contributing and someone who is prescient. And that's what we need to be. That's where we need to be. We need to be the people. Everyone says, well, you're actually right about this stuff. You were right all along. And that's where we want to be. That's where we've got to, where we've got to at the moment. It's because we were right. We knew we were right about the Jewish power, because all of a sudden everyone realized, well, hang on a minute, this is exactly what they were saying all this time. And now they're trying to come in and steal the point because they want to control the narrative. We can't allow that.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I totally agree with you. You made so many brilliant points there, and I've got a couple questions from the audience also that I'd like to ask you. But first, I want to say, like, thanks, man, because so many connections just made. You know, the allegory between like Goebbels and his radio transmitters to our use of Twitter, our use of AI. These things are tools that we should take advantage of and use in the fight. Right? It's like leaving your knife at home. When you're going out into the city or something, you want to have your tools available and you want to know how to use them. I do see a lot of people resisting AI. A lot of people won't go to Twitter because they go there and they get banned. And I kind of throw out there that you're not using it right, or that, you know, that there has to be some tactics involved. But I think that's brilliant. That's a brilliant allegory. And also, you'd also kind of mentioned about I'm not sure that I can put this into a good question. So Annie's got a question that ties into this. And so her question is, since most of the recent debanking came from elements within our ranks, which I think is it's kind of there's sort of an Antifa element kind of going on the right side, in our side. That's trying to demonetize, that's trying to demoralize, trying to counter signal. There's of course always been a lot of counter signaling going on, but I think a lot of this can be I'm not sure that it can be prevented, but she says, how do we protect ourselves from this? And apparently it's still going on. I kind of want to add to that. Like, is this just a matter of education or a matter of insistence that not only do we need this diversity of tactics, but they're putting themselves in a corral and lessening their chances of success by taking down people that are fighting the same enemy. It seems like a really simple question, but this happens a lot. I think
a lot of it does. It is often happening. Okay.
So how do we? I think her question is, how do we protect ourselves from it? How do we stop those motherfuckers from that shit?
Well, first of all, you can't. The honest question is, you can't. It'd be a lovely gift if I could say yes if you just do X, Y, Z. First of all, you do need to do basic OPSEC. So operational security. Make sure that you have as little digital footprint in your own name as you can. And there are people in our movement who can help you with that. I know of some of them because one of them managed to work out my real name, actually, as it happens. And he told me how. And I immediately sunk the way he did it. And he's since tried again with a couple of people, and they can't get to it now. They can't get any way to my actual name. So that's positive. But that's the point, is that we must take responsibility for ourselves and control our internet use, our profiles, our links to ourselves, make sure everything is completely separate. No lapses as best you can. But also, fundamentally, it's people are always going to try these tactics with you. They're always going to try and go after you personally because they can't win in normal way. They have to go after you personally. It's the example I give you is Trotskyites in the left. This is what Trotskyites in the left. They are a subversive element. They've been a subversive element in Marxism for a very long time. And Marxism has a huge problem with Trotskyites getting into things and then subverting them and taking them over. And not so much these days, but this is really in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. It was a huge issue for the Marxist left. And that's basically what you're dealing with. You're dealing with people who want to subvert you. And the way to deal with it is to just accept it.
Right.
Accept what it is. Do not allow and don't allow people into positions of power or in any kind of influence who have, shall we say, who start from being, like, I guess, edgy for the sake of edgy. That would be the way I would put it.
Great way to put it.
People who don't put it, who don't seem to have the courage of their convictions, they want to talk about, they want to talk in, like, extreme terms quite a lot, not just using cuss words, but actually talking in terms of solutions in the sense we all know. And don't fall into any of those traps. Don't get away from them, because even if they are sincere, you will get caught up in something, and that's not good. And to get, if you want to look up an example, look up Hal Turner. He was an FBI informant who in the old racial right around the 90s, who basically was famous for this, and he basically was an FBI informant. So just focus on doing the right stuff, accept the consequences as such as they are, and just use your common sense. Like, make sure your upsec's good. Make sure you, make sure you're with good people. I mean, I shouldn't have to tell anyone who good people are. People who will give you the shirt off their back as long, like you will them. I mean, it's basically it. It's not a difficult concept to me at all.
I think most people, you want to be the especially people on our side, they have a sense, yes, of who the good guys are and who could be subversive. It's a great point. You know, OPSEC, part of OPSEC is considering that, there's a potential on your side that your side is not only subverted, but it's infiltrated, and that, it's possible the person right next to you could be, an anti-ideologue.
It's not if, it's when. Because remember, the NSDAP was absolutely filled with informers. It had loads of informers in it. It had loads of people, Johnny Come Lately's, people who were trying to subvert it from the inside, people trying to split the party, you name it, it was going on. So don't,
and this got much worse, you know, as the pressure mounted, right? Is it looked like they were posted?
That's going to happen. It kind of, you know, if you think it's bad now, you wait in 5 to 10 years time.
Yeah, makes sense. Another question that we had from Varietas Veritas. He says, what's Carl's view on why the most anti-Semitic movement achieves power? As soon as they do, they become more diplomatic when it comes to how to address the JQ. I'm going to assume that he's referring to the Reich. And was there a difference in the way that they approached anti-Semitism before and after they came to power?
Not really. I kind of think I know what he's getting at, which is that it's rhetoric versus reality, in that we can have a conversation about the rhetoric about, you know, we need to get the Jews out of Germany, whatever. But there is a practical element to this, in that it's not just the Jews. They're at the top of the list, but it's not just them. So when you say they talk about the most extreme, they were the most extreme of the period, but they're also the ones who followed through. There are a lot of groups at the time, like, for example, in Hungary, in Romania, places like that, which were very anti-Jewish, but they had anti-Jewish laws, but they didn't do very much about them. The Reich did, and the Reich did it in pretty record time, given the scale of the problem was much larger. But also, they moved, if you remember, from pretty much early on, they began looking at solutions. We might have problems with some solutions they came up with, because quite clearly, you know, in our world, the terms are different. But at the time, it wasn't, what they were doing was quite revolutionary, in that they, someone was pointing this out the other day, that one of the great myths is that this myth that the NSDAP were like going around beating up Jews in the campsite and they stopped. The truth is that they weren't particularly doing that. They were doing a bit of it. But a lot of the time, it was the communists who were killing everyone else. It wasn't the NSDAP, it was the Communist Party, who were shooting everyone, at doing all sorts of things, bombings, you name it. And then, when they came to power, the SR created what they call wild camps. And that was about 1,000 Jews were imprisoned or killed in those camps. And this was if you go back and read some literature of the time, you'll see that they were shrieking about this internationally. And the truth is very simple, is that you have finite resources to deal with some very large problems. So you have to pick your battles, which is why the NSDAP really went after some, like, the, you know, the low-hanging fruit in 1933, particularly on the homosexual point. But then it took till 1936, 1937 to really go after the rest, because it comes back to that, you know, let's set a priority list. Our priority list in this case was Jews, communists, and there was a bit of homosexuals, because the homosexuals that they went after were prime, was the real public face of it, and particularly the ones linked to the Communist Party, like the like Herschel, that Institute. The point being that I hate to use the term negatively, but purist bar, and say, well, they didn't start, you know, throwing them out on day one. Well, they did. It's just throwing hundreds of thousands of people out on day one is incredibly hard to do, and you'll get into problems, because there's lots of other considerations that need to be taken into account. You need to deal with other things as well. You need to deal with, at that point, they were dealing with the economic crisis. They were dealing with all sorts of things together, and their anti-Jewish policies were about as radical as you could go at the time without triggering other problems. Which is why I say, is people, it's always look at something in context, not in terms of pure ideology. What you prefer to happen is not what can happen immediately. However, that doesn't mean to say it shouldn't start happening immediately, and it did. That's the difference. It's not that it didn't start happening. It's just it wasn't going as quickly as we might like, because there were practical considerations involved. For example, you had to create the Nuremberg Laws. You had to find who was Jew and who was not. You had to start looking at how do we do this? How do we do this and not crash the economy? We're not trying to.
I think we're getting a lot of robot.
We're not trying to stop. of millions of people, but to, because we're trying to purely spot out comment about, you know, our economy. That's not the point. People. And to do that, there is some, without going on too long.
No, no worries. It's just the, it's the cell phone reception, I think, drops out. And so we're getting some audio dropouts. And I apologize for that. It's just part of technology, right? You know, Irving kind of addressed this as well. There were straight up logistic nightmares. They needed their railways for soldiers and supplies. They didn't have the means to move Jews until after the war. And that was something that that he had addressed in one of his, in his book on Goebbels as well.
Yeah, it's ironic. And that's the, it's also the irony of people thinking that that the whole final solution was nothing to do with the economic plans that everyone seems to forget had begun to become into effect in 1943, which is when a lot of this movement really starts happening, to move large sections of the Jewish population to the camps in the east, because it's all part of the economic program to get to move. Like, you know, famously, Stalin moved large amounts of Soviet industry from Western Russia into around the Urals. The Germans did the same thing. They moved stuff from the Ruhr to Poland because it was outside the bombing range, or it was harder to bomb. So that's what they did. That's the origin of camps like Auschwitz and Stutthof. They were massive manufacturing centers. And of course, choosing the workforce.
Right. Just reinforcing the idea that they were labor camps and not death camps, you know, which.
Exactly.
Yep. Ethno-nationalist says, what is Carl thinking about what Putin said about the Jews the other day? I'm going to assume that, I don't know, I'm not sure if you're aware. I think Putin did make some remarks about Jews last week. I saw it on Twitter briefly. Are you familiar with that incident? Or
not familiar with it. I don't know what he said. If ethno-nationalist could actually state what he said, because I know he said about the fact that it's well known in Russia, but for some reason gets denied a lot in the West, and that Jews are massively involved in the Bolshevik Revolution and then under Stalin.
Yeah, I'm not sure we can answer that. I could look the tweet, or I could pull the tweet up, but then I can't play it because of the audio, the audio situation with the looping. No. So actually he could just follow up with Carl, you know, on Twitter, you know, specifically DM him on it and send him the tweet. I think it's about the best way that I can actually handle that one. Let's see. I think that's, oh, there was one more question, and this was a really, I think, general question, but it came from Clap, and he left it for me last night because in case he wasn't able to be here today. But he says, what do people get wrong the most about history? And I don't really want to, you know, I guess I could make it more specific. You know, is there something that you perceive that people should know, or something that they get wrong that's the biggest problem? Like, is there something that you commonly run into all the time that people believe that's just simply wrong? Or you know, is there something that you see repeatedly that's potentially detrimental to our cause?
There's a lot of things. I've actually just looked up the comments, by the way, about Putin. I see what's been referred to. I'll deal with those afterwards. But the thing I think people most get wrong about history is that they often exclude context. And by that, I mean, there's a lot of things that happen in history, but unless you put them in their context, you don't know why they happened. And a lot of people, and Jews are very good at pretending that there is no context, or the context doesn't exist, or it's a very particular context. And when you, there's a saying among feminist historians which they say feminist history is you add women and stir. And I would say if you, when you take Jewish history and you take history in general, if you add the context and stir, you will find out why something is happening. Because when you do that, the reason something is happening appears. I mean, it's like looking at, what we kind of talked about is, where does National Socialism come from? Where does the radical right, where does anti-Semitism come from in the 1910s and 20s? The truth is because it started 50 years, 60 years beforehand. it had its roots in those years, and then is then reinforced by what happens in Russia in World War One. Then World War One, and then we have a bunch of other things that happen around the same time. It's that context. If you just say, it's like, I guess a great example is the 1933 boycott of Jewish goods in Germany. People don't mention the context of, well, they were boycotting them because a bunch of American Jews had decided it was a great idea to boycott German goods, and it was hurting Germany quite significantly via their foreign exchange reserves. And that's in essence what it was. It was a response to an action by the Jewish community in the United States trying to, you know, hurt the German state and destroy the nascent German state. And that's all it ever was. It wasn't some, you know, prevaricated campaign or whatever it is they want to claim, because that's what you'll see. But
right,
it was never had the context.
No, you're absolutely right. And this happens every single time, pun intended, because there always is context, and it usually involves a provocation or some other situation that would naturally lead people to anti-Jewish activity. We've seen this, time and time and time again. It happens in the modern day. We talked about the Night of the Long Knives earlier. There was a lot of missing context around that as well. And that's a great point. Like, it's very easy to cite a specific thing and use that thing as a cudgel against your opponent. But when the context is taken into account, oftentimes just with a little bit of knowledge of the historical context, we can not only flip that argument, but we can defeat them with their own assertions.
Yes. And that's the truth of things like, when you begin to look at like the events in history, it's not just the Third Reich, it predates it. You start to look at why did the Romans, Greeks and Romans really have a problem with Jews? Well, it's because of what they were doing. If you read what they said, they made it very clear why. But they don't want to talk about that. They want to say that they want to make it all about, oh, you know, they're a bit odd. They have, you know, they have weird food habits. They have, you know, they pray to a non-existent entity, etc. They don't talk about what the other things they say about all the revolts, all the murders, all the fanaticism, all the destruction of temples, you name it. They were doing it. And again, without that context, it looks one way. You add the context, all of a sudden, it's not the Greeks and the Romans that are being irrational. It's they're responding to Jewish behavior. And that's what they don't want. That's the bit they don't want to really talk about. Because the minute anti-Semitism becomes about Jewish behavior as a response to it, all of a sudden, Jews have done something wrong. When Jews have done something wrong, people go, well, what else have they done wrong? Because there's such a wall of silence built up over the years that you can't question this, because if you question this, you are evil. But people still have questions. They're just not asked or not answered.
That's important.
That's what happens. And that's what's now being to see is people have questions. Okay, I've been taught about the Holocaust since I was, five. Why don't they mention the Holodomor? Why don't they mention the Kazakh genocide? Why don't they mention all these other things? But they want to mention the Holocaust. Why? What has that got to do with me? And it comes back to this whole thing of we need to, it's focusing on, you know, focusing on the key things, keep pushing at the key points that we have. The more you push, the more people have to try and answer you. And when they try and answer you, they'll expose more people to your positions and so on and so forth. That's the way you win.
That's a great way to kind of round things up as we're coming very close to the 2-hour mark.
Yeah.
Is that it really comes back to continue to ask the questions, continue to pose these questions very publicly, continue to press them on the answers, and continue to bring the correct historical context to their accusations. And as we become more and more organized and better at articulating these counterarguments, we will begin to score major victories. I think that, we still have a lot of a part to play in the fight against Jewish supremacy, and we have to continue doing what we've been doing and even more of it.
I was going to say, it's to keep. It's not that we are the only people who are going to say things, but we need to be at the front of the queue. We need to be the people saying, "Look, we were right all along. we have a track record of being right. This is why we're right. You are wrong because you're trying to dilute this point by trying to make it something else. So, you know, you are wrong because, and then keep off and just don't let up. Don't let them have oxygen. Don't let them have room to maneuver. You just keep pushing and pushing, nailing them down. And they will run. They will look stupid. They'll lose followers. They'll lose relevance. And as you keep doing it, you will keep succeeding. You'll keep winning. And in the end, you will get into power one way or another.
You know, I think I'm beginning to understand why you never tire of answering the same questions over and over, of handling the same, you know, fools with the same talking points. You know, for a while, it kind of confused me. I thought, man, Carl sure is, he's got a great personality. He seems to be in a really good mood all the time. How is that even possible? Because he's constantly having to battle with these fuckwits on Twitter. But you're actually right. You're simply, it's a pleasure to do not only the right thing, but this is necessary. And every time you have to answer the same question again, it's another opportunity for onlookers that weren't there the first time to hear the answers. And this is how awareness spreads. This is how we succeed, is just by propagation. Yes. Carl Rattles is a genius, ladies and gentlemen. I'm definitely going to have you back again. And because you've been very busy, you have a very active Substack, and I've got the link in the description, guys. Be sure to follow Carl and check out his Substack. He's a very active contributor, and he writes some great stuff, and it's really right up your alley. A lot of it's good information, supplemental things, the historical context that he's talking about in a lot of cases. You do really good work, and you were putting a book together, I think, last time we talked.
Five.
What's going on with your book?
So I sent out the first bunch of them to people for free because I'm me. And I'm just waiting to hear back about, once they start getting to people, I'll put the PDFs online, and then everyone can read the first five. There's another two or three that are pretty close to being done as well.
So several works in the works. That's amazing. I think we were talking about the origins of the protocols last time, and yeah, I'm definitely interested in getting getting those. So guys, follow Carl on his Substack, and we don't have to wrap things up, but I try to be respectful of your time. And
no,
I'm
it's
sure
fine. We can go for another 20 minutes or so. It's fine. Well, we had a period of like not being able to talk. So it's worth giving people their money's worth, so to speak.
I like that. I like the way you think. I'm absolutely for it. But I'm kind of out of places. I don't really have any other plans to go. So
it's fine. I mean, we have the Putin trope thing.
Yeah, let's do the Putin thing because you looked that up.
Yeah, so it's basically that Putin said that ethnic Jews are tearing apart the Russian Orthodox Church. Sorry. He said, these people are attacking the church. They're not atheists. They are absolutely faithless people, godless people. Well, ethnically, many of them are Jews, but you haven't seen them visit a synagogue. His point is completely valid. And, of course, they're kvetching about it, saying, you know, it's Stalin, it's rootless cosmopolitans and all that stuff. The truth is that Putin, but I wouldn't say Putin's an anti-Semite, he's just a realist. He understands that, fundamentally, that there's a lot of people who are opposed to Russia right now who are Jewish, but also there's a lot of people who support Putin who are Jewish. There's a lot of his close confreres, some of his people he admires quite a lot, were Jewish or are Jewish, if you actually look them up. It's not that he's somehow this, you know, the grand moth anti-Semite or something, but he's a realist. It's like the same thing like when you see the Japanese have quite a healthy anti-Jewish literature, interestingly, and it's because they realize the fundamental truth of what's going on, but they don't look at it the same way we do because they're not the ones being subverted so much, or don't have the same issues, or in their case, I think now they're starting to have to deal with it, but not in the same way as of yet.
Yeah, so under different circumstances.
Yeah, it's just that he's recognizing a fundamental reality that there's a lot of Jews trying to subvert the Russian state for whatever reason, probably because a lot of the oligarchs, of course, were themselves Jewish. And also because Putin does have a track record of calling out facts that are well known in Russia and well known in literature, but are absolutely denied by a lot of people online, a lot of people in positions of power in the West, which is like the Jewish and the Bolshevik Revolution, and so on and so forth.
I often wonder why he provokes so much of a response from a media that's normally not responsive to anything, and that makes a great point. I think
it's just polarizing Putler, isn't it?
Well, you know, there's an ongoing battle within the right about, you know, Putin and whether or not he's actually serving the interest of Jews, or if he's actually trying to serve his people. And this has become a fight that's actually caused quite a bit of division within our ranks in the last few years.
Yeah. Oh, no, I completely agree. It's going to, because you'll get these fights where so-and-so person comes along and someone says, well, you know, they're the next Hitler, or they're the next XYZ. The truth is, he's not. He's following an ideology. It's an old one. It's classic. He's not engaging in Pan-Slavism. They've called it Orthodox nationalism around the 1900s, when you had people who believed in spreading the orthodoxy and was the key thing, and it was not so much about race, whereas the Pan-Slavists were much more about race. So yeah, it's just there's always context to this kind of thing, and I'm always a bit wary of picking sides in debates like this, because I always think it's when you look at both sides, you see that there's Jews who support Putin. There's a bunch of Jews, of course, and plus Zelensky, who's of course Jewish himself, who support the Ukrainians. The people, I always say, the people who will lose are the Russian people, the Russian people and the Ukrainian people, and anyone else who serves in those areas. And it's because they're fighting and dying for governments that, if I'm honest, I'm not. I mean, Putin's better than Zelensky if I was going to pick a side. He's better, but not by much.
Right.
Then it's just, you'd have to kind of deal with it and just kind of be like, okay, right, well,
the more common denominator is dead civilians, dead white people, and more than it is even Jews.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Because, you know, I was looking up the amount of Jews that have fled from the Ukraine, and of course, basically there's no Jews in Ukraine anymore. They're all buggered off to Germany, not to Israel. They went to Germany, rather surprisingly.
That's kind of interesting, because I've heard a lot of conspiracy around the Greater Israel Project and the idea that Ukraine would become the new Jerusalem, you know?
Oh, I can believe it, but it's based upon the idea that because there's a bunch of Hasidic saints in the Ukraine, because of course the Pale settlement and all that jazz, that basically you've got that situation, and people just run with it, and there is truth in it, in the sense that it was a twice mooted Jewish homeland was Ukraine, well, specifically the Crimea.
Sure.
But it was mooted twice during the Soviet Union to Stalin, and Stalin rejected it both times. And it may have actually been the second time by Solomon Lobzovsky, the head of the Profintern, pretty much did it in 1943, and Stalin just basically called him scum, which is rather Stalin, to be honest with you. And probably contributed to why Lobzovsky basically got purged by Stalin in the late 40s. But yeah, that comes back to, you know, when you look at context, when you start to wonder why did Stalin go after Jews in the Soviet Union? Well, he didn't really go after the Jews. He went after the Zionists, as he would call them. Why was he doing that? Well, because of what they were doing. It's not because they were Jews. It's because of what they were doing, and they were Jewish nationalists, and he viewed that as being opposed to, pretty much rightly, as opposed to Marxism. So yeah, that's how he kind of worked.
Yeah, that's another bombshell point, actually. I mean, you make this is a huge point, and I think I remember kind of taking this position long ago, but we really do need to keep this on the things that they've done, not who they are, because they're constantly trying to make it about their identity, but it's about their crimes and about their undermining of nations. That's the JQ. It's not about identity. That's an important thing to point out.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing, is that we need to focus on who they are and what they are, not their not what they claim to be. Because that's a real problem that we have, is that a lot of people want to buy into the frame that Jews want to create. They do not want to deal with the reality of, you know, that Jews are fundamentally Jews are something specific. But if you listen to them less and look at what they do internally more, you will see it, for lack of a better term.
It's a great point.
And it's something I see a lot with people, is people say, oh, you know, I can't, you know, I can't look at them that way. I've got, you know, XYZ friend or whatever. He's not, you know, this person's not part of a conspiracy. He's part of their, you know, it's just a rhetorical tactic. And you just say, well, you know, why do you believe them? B, I don't believe in a massive, very great Jewish conspiracy. I believe Jews act like anyone else does. They act for the interest of their people and themselves first and foremost. And sometimes they will do things that piss off other Jews, which is why you get Jews denouncing other Jews to Gentiles, which is a whole different subsector.
Right.
Subsect of their own little world of, you've got these Jews who are, I'm anti-Semitic. No, you're not. you're trying to co-opt anti-Semitism to make it Jew-friendly.
It's the same tactic used against the common argument. We see this all the time. You know, I think Hitler addressed it. I recall reading in Mein Kampf something, and boiled down, it was basically that whether or not Jews intend to undermine our nations is not really our concern. The fact that they're doing that is our concern. And that's why,
yeah,
you know, that was his justification against the whole not all Jews are bad kind of thing. It's like it doesn't really matter what their intention is. Their actions point, you know, in the direction of the destruction of Germany.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like actions have consequences.
Exactly. And that relieves you of a lot of, a lot of juggling, you know, morality, because it's not really about their identity, and it's not about whether or not all Jews intend to do this or there's a conspiracy. It's just a simple fact that when you have Jews controlling your country is going to get destroyed. And we've seen that. That's been backed up time and time again throughout history.
Yeah, it's just what happens is that you...
So we've got to reframe that argument in that way.
Yeah. It's that whole manosphere thing, if you know that about it. It's the terms of you never let them control the frame. You always assert control of the frame. And by asserting control of the frame, you force them to come into your world and deal with your reality, with your arguments, not you with theirs. Which is why a lot of if you see how Jews argue, normally it's somewhere along the lines of, what about this? What about that? Or you just X, Y, Z. It's accusatory. They accuse, and then they'll try and be your friend. It's the next stage. I actually wrote an article about it called The Stages of Kvetching, how Jews argue, basically, in that they start out by being hyper-aggressive, and then they will try and be your friend, because when you put them down, they try and be your friend. They try and do the concern troll you, basically, and say, well, you know, what about me? You know, I'm just a normal person, blah, blah, blah. And then they will go back to being ultra aggressive, name calling. And then they just poof back into, they don't know what to do at that point, because you've just gone through all the stages of how they work. And you say, no, you deal with this or you can go away. And then they end up just basically going away with their tails between their legs.
Right. They become that slippery goo that Hitler mentions, right?
Yeah, and they'll come back with that aggressive tone. You just kick them in the nuts again. And say, you know, go back to where you came from. It's a lot of people think it's a lot harder than it actually is. And people always wonder, why do you deal with these like small, seemingly inconsequential issues? Like, did Jews invent the bagel? Did Jews invent the pastrami? Why? Because what they will do is they will try and find anything to get you to say Jews are okay. So if there is something that they think they've got on you, they will try and use it. And they will try and say, well, you know, you shouldn't eat bagels then. Well, in fact, bagels are Polish-German. They're not Jewish at all. But that's the point. They will try to say something, to push something, to make you answer to them, not them to you. You need to force them to answer to you. And trust me when I say that when you do that, you start to see what can't remember his name now. The guy who Eckhart called a good Jew. I can't remember his name. Otto Weinberger. He, in his Sex and Character, he said basically that Jews are feminine, whereas Aryans are masculine, and they have that, as they would say these days, energy. They will qualify to you, but even then, people say, well, you know, he was good. Hitler said he was a good Jew. Well, actually, that was Dietrich Eckart writing and saying it was Hitler. But the point is that when you actually read what Weininger wrote, there's a character, you see that actually he wasn't saying what Eckart says he was saying. He was saying that, yes, they have feminine energy, but he also denies that Jews are a racial group, or there is a racial basis for Jews. He just thinks that it's a religious thing. Like it's a character, a cultural thing. So that's part of the danger of someone saying, well, oh, he's okay because he said X. Well, okay, what did he really say though? What is he really saying? What is he really talking about? What is his real agenda here? And that's why Alexander was always right when he said no Jews, just right.
Right. And I guess it just comes kind of right back to having a fundamental platform, sticking to it, and asserting that, this was the catechism, right? Like this is what you think and this is why you think it, and stick to that and you'll be successful.
Yeah. And you will have no problems because you know the truth. And by standing your ground, you force them to try and innovate, to attack you. And that's when you would go to other people and say, look, I'm a bit out of my depth here. Can you help? That's when you get other people in who know their stuff better, who can then say, okay, well, this is a new argument. This is why it's wrong.
Wow, that's a really big deal.
And then that goes into the catechism, if you understand me. And then you build on it that way.
Yeah. That's a big deal. The thing about, putting them on their, basically put them on their heels and don't let them, like you said, command the frame, right? You've got to take control of the frame. You have to, stick to simple points, counterpoints, and then, provide the context in cases where they're trying to basically gotcha you into submission and then putting you on defense. So it's a little bit of a chess move, but the more it's practiced, the better we would get at it.
It is practice makes perfect, because I mean, people see me arguing with people on Twitter and whatever, and I've been doing that for 20, I've been arguing with people like that for 20 something years. I mean, it's not new to me. I've done it. I've pretty much every argument that they could conceive of, I've seen about 20 times or 30 times or 1,000 times. And if I've not seen it in that context, I've seen it used in anti-German propaganda from the 30s or the 40s. I mean, all the best arguments are old ones. I know the best arguments against national socialism because I've seen them used, and I've seen how they use them and how they've used them best. And because of that, I know how to deal with them. That's the difference. That's why national socialism is right, because it's about struggle. It's about you have to take personal responsibility for the future of the Aryan race. And that has consequences. And you have to internalize that. And you have to realize that it's about struggling upwards. You're never going to be perfect. No one's expecting you to be perfect. But people are expecting you to try and at least work at it. Because we've all got our flaws.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense. And the more you strengthen something, the better that we'll get at it, just like training muscles or any other kind of repetitive training.
Yeah. Brilliant. And that's brilliant the simple stuff. Truth.
Carl Rattle, everybody, we're pretty much coming up to the end, I think, of the interview. But I want to say thanks again for taking the time to come hang out with us. It's always a pleasure to just sit down and have a conversation, especially with you, because you're so smart and you tend to go in the direction that I was going to go anyway. So it's a very fluid conversation. But if you guys missed any of the references, any of the books, I'm going to try to get a clean replay uploaded. I know that there were some technical issues earlier. I'll see if I can get the raw recording back from stream and probably can clean up the audio a little bit to put that out. So we'll have that out a little bit later today. But I want to thank everybody that had questions. Is there anything else that you'd care to address or point people toward? Obviously, you've got a Substack and a Twitter that they could follow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just all I have to say really is focus on, you know, if you do have questions, just at me, or just use the app, just at me on Twitter, or say something, or ask a question, or whatever, and I will respond to you. If I don't respond, just at me again until I do, because sometimes, unfortunately, notifications don't always come through because I get a lot of them. But the best will in the world is if you just take it as you need to, you have the truth. If you don't know something, ask. No one is going to crucify you because you don't know something. And if they do, just mute them because they're an asshole. The simple truth is if you just do that, you do a bit of work on your side, you put what you see into practice and you try and live it as best you can. No one's expecting you to be perfect. Then you will get there. We will get to the Fourth Reich eventually. And it's not going to be tomorrow. It's not going to be next week, but it might be in a couple of years from now. It might be in 50 years from now. But the point is what we do now echoes in eternity.
Man, what a shot of great medicine. Thanks again for joining. I'm going to let you go about your day. Have a fantastic holiday, please. And, I'd like to follow up with you after the holiday just to get you lined up for the next one, because we always want to bring you back as much as possible. Thanks for spending time with us.
And thank you to all your listeners, all the people in the chat, and you know, and thank you to you for organizing it and being patient around the silly communication issues we sometimes have.
Yeah, if there's one thing that I do best, it's communication issues. also, I wanted to point out to Huntress that you really enjoyed the song that she made for you.
I did.
I kind of thanked her on your behalf, but she's in the chat. Tell her how much you loved it, just because I know that she enjoys the feedback, and maybe we'll get her to make you another song.
But I was so thank you, Huntress. I was genuinely surprised. That was a genuine surprise. I wasn't expecting that at all. It's well sung. I really like it. I've actually downloaded it, and my wife said it as well, and she likes it.
That's awesome. You know, it's just nice. But like some small things like that, like you had communicated to me last night, that you know, life can be such a drudge, and it's those small things that really, you know, make things better sometimes. Can really uplift you in a low point.
Yeah.
Completely. So guys, don't forget to make those gestures to each other, you know, and to our people. Take the time to just let them know that you care about them, or you know, give them a little something that lets them know you're thinking about them.
Yeah.
Well, Carl, thanks for joining us. I'll cut this off here, and then I'll kind of bring the stream to a close. But thanks again, and I'll definitely be in touch. Keep an eye on your Telegram after the holiday.
Oh, yeah, we'll do.
Thank you very much, sir. And have a great Christmas.
See you, Carl.
Oh, I cut him off. That's what I'm supposed to do. Wouldn't be the Flood Show if we didn't cut the guest off, would it? Guys, that's Carl Rattle. Of course, he's a very esteemed guest. We're going to get him a trophy or something one of these days that he's put up with almost 15 hours of the Flood Show in total. And I'm always blown away by how he's capable of simplifying really complex things and then delivering them in a way that's that kind of gives me a little bit of hope. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I've been a little bit depressed and demoralized like a lot of people lately. And it's always a pleasure to talk to him, because he does make it really, really simple that we're on the right track, and that all we need to do is stay the course. And even in times of trouble, just remember that, you know, great men have gone before us, and they've gone down this path, and we can learn from what they did. And if we model ourselves after success, eventually we will also be successful. So, you know, train yourself, not only strong, you know, get on a better diet if you're on a bad diet, get on a better exercise plan. If you're not healthy, try to get healthy. If you're not well-read, try to read more, try to improve yourself. You don't have to be perfect, you know, tomorrow, but you should try to improve yourself every day, and you'll see improvements directly in society if everybody does that. I think that's it's a real simple and fundamental thing, but it's something that we often forget, and it's easy to overlook, and it's easy in the face of all the bad news and all the sensational stuff happening to lose sight of those fundamentals. So Carl's always great to remind us of those things. I'm going to work on getting this thing uploaded. I do apologize for the audio problems. They're still, cell phones are tough, and I'll check and see, you know, what we can improve on our end to kind of minimize those sorts of things. I'm not sure how much Restream retained until I listened to the recording, but I want to thank everybody for taking the time to spend with us this morning. We ran a little bit longer than normal. Let me just take a look here. It's 8:30 already. Okay, I'm just going to go ahead. I'm going to play one song, and then I'm going to wrap this up. But I want to say thanks to all the people that supported the show. Thank you to Dave Gahari. Thanks to G-Man. Thanks to Josh Hu for giving us FTJ. Big, big thank you to Anonymous Goy, Boo Boo, and Spy Hunter for giving us a place to work over on White Pilled. I appreciate you guys all working with us and being very calm and patient and polite through the audio problems that we had. And thank you to the people that supported the show. That's Kermie. He said about specific historical events. Yeah, okay, you asked the clap question, right? I think we covered that. Thank you, Bigot Smalls. I appreciate that that donation interruption.